Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for the kind invitation to come and say a few words. I think after Simon, I feel a bit like the reserved best man at a wedding, partly because I'm following a couple of good speakers and partly because I have no policy or operational responsibility for mental health, despite being the NHS medical director. That will change on the 1st of April next year. So I'm here really seeking help and advice, and I'm sure the latter will come in spadefuls. When I listened to Richard opening, I was reminded of how sometimes the medical profession or the clinical professions know what to do but simply don't do it. And a good example of that would have been MRSA. So some years ago, the Daily Mail increased its circulation, I guess, by telling terrible stories about MRSA. The public became alarmed, and eventually John Reid, who was Secretary of State, became pretty irate and said, I've had enough of this. I want the MRSA rate halved over the next 3 years. And I, in those days, I'm a heart surgeon by background. I used to spend a lot of my time on intensive care units, and I remember this sort of diktat coming down, and we looked at each other when we saw this, and we thought, what are they smoking? You know, it just can't happen. These patients are sick. They are immunosuppressed. MRSA is the price you pay for the technological advances that go on in ITU. So only a few years on, the MRSA rate is down 60%, and sometimes it's really fantastic to be wrong. And we now have fantastic MRSA rates which compare very favorably internationally. But the worrying thing about that was that the medical profession, nursing professions, knew what to do all along. It took external influence to inject the ambition into the professionals. And I'm just feeling a little bit of deja vu with some of the evidence that Richard has presented. You know, the measure of a country's civilization, I think, is how readily it adopts science, how readily it engages in the arts, and how compassionately it deals with the most vulnerable members of its society. And just a short walk around this building will show that we are major leaders in science. We've got the second highest number of Nobel Prizes overall and for medicine. In terms of the arts, this country set up the Arts Council in 1940, right in the middle of the war, set up by John Maynard Keynes, so not surprisingly it was well-funded and remains so. And we had the World Shakespeare Festival celebrating one of our great playwrights. So we've done well on the arts. And looking after the vulnerable, we did pretty well. We established the first integrated healthcare system free at the point of delivery for all citizens. Fantastic achievement. And you only have to have turned on the television in the last couple of weeks to have seen the Paralympics and to see the massive outpouring of initially national compassion, followed by utter admiration for people who had overcome some pretty serious disabilities. Sadly, that care of the vulnerable doesn't extend yet, in my view, to the totality of people who suffer mental health. So we've heard the magnitude of the problem, and I will remember 40%. The magnitude of the problem's well rehearsed. We know about the personal suffering. We know about the impact on families, because mental health is not necessarily just a disease of the individual. It also afflicts families. And we've heard very eloquently from Richard Layard the impact on the economy. But dealing with mental health, in my view, is a really complex and difficult issue because it's an array of conditions. It's not one or two single conditions. Research is difficult. As one of my surgical colleagues said, you can't take samples of the brain easily. So research has to be conducted in a slightly different way to many other parts of medicine. Mental health affects children. It affects youths. It has a major impact on the criminal justice system. Up to 70% of young kids who are in trouble with the criminal justice system have some kind of mental health issues which, if they were addressed properly, could save them from a life of misery and save money from the economy. And, of course, it affects adults with both social and physical conditions. And it affects the elderly, although I think that's pretty underrepresented in what we see. So the issue is, how can the NHS help? And that's where we start to get into some complex discussions, which I hope we'll flesh out later tonight. But in 1948, when the NHS was founded, Nye Bevan described it as the most civilized achievement of modern government. And indeed it was. But I put it to you, and not everybody likes this, our NHS went into slow decay, like a very elegant colonial building, over the course of about 60 years. We became complacent in the knowledge that we had the most compassionate and sympathetic healthcare system in the world, and that we offered pretty good technocratic results for most of the things that we tried to treat. And in a previous life, I used to spend quite a lot of time going to the United States. And I remember I was in Washington once, and there were a bunch of surgeons, and I was introduced, and they were told I came from England, and some guy said to me, do you work for the NHS? And I said, yes. I was feeling quite proud about that. And he said, you know, that's nice. But like the front page of Private Eye, there was a bubble coming out of his head, and I could see him thinking, poor guy, he's a white-coated automaton who works in a Stalinist bureaucracy in a concrete-clad building where patients queue around the block, hoping that they're still alive when they get to the front of the queue. And, of course, then I spent the rest of the conversation defending the NHS, and I would come back to Birmingham, where I would sit in a clinic, and two people would come in for their heart operation, usually a man and his wife, and the man would usually be the person that needed the operation, and we'd go through a sort of 40-minute discussion on his condition and the options that were available for him, and then he'd say, yeah, he agreed to surgery, but it would include a hard-nosed discussion about the risk of death, the risk of infection, the risk of renal failure, the risk of stroke. And then I would turn to his wife and I'd say, any questions? And she would say, just one. And I'd say, what's that? And she would say, when? And I would say, 18 months to 2 years. And this look of abject terror would descend across her face, and her eyes would cloud over with tears, and she would say, we waited a year to see the cardiologist. We've waited 3 months to see you. When is this ever going to stop? Will he survive? And at that point, sometimes a bubble would come out of my head, which would say, don't blame me, I have to work here. And in a more realistic sense, I recognized that we were operating in a healthcare system which was technocratically good, but in some ways still had a third world element to it. And we didn't recognize the importance of immediacy of care and access to care and timely care and how important that was for patients. And then round about that time, there was a lot of bad press about bad things going on with children's heart surgery in Bristol, people being fried with too much x-rays down in the south. There were issues over waiting times in the NHS, particularly in orthopedics. And a new government came in, which was the Blair government of the day. And they doubled the investment in the NHS, but they coupled that with a whole lot of performance targets. They coupled it with regulation. And they introduced national service frameworks for certain conditions. And some of the early national service frameworks were around mental health, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. And they had a big impact. The starting position was that our NHS wasn't providing the service that it should, and that with the right kind of tripartite arrangements between the clinical professionals, the Department of Health, and the Treasury, things could be put in place to make things better for the citizens of this country. And they worked. And in my specialty, by the time I stopped clinical practice at the end of 2007, when I was working at UCL, I would have a similar clinic and two people would come in, and we'd go through the same discussion. I'd ask the guy's wife if she had any questions, and she'd say, just one. And I'd say, what's that? And she would say, when? And I'd say, well, what about next Wednesday or Thursday? And this look of abject terror would descend on her face. And they'd say, we thought the waiting lists were long. We're going on holiday. But it was a much more agreeable position to be in. And so in relatively short order, the NHS was transformed from people worrying not just about whether they were going to get treatment, but it enabled them then to focus on whether they were getting the right treatment and the quality of care. And during that time, you know, there have been some pretty massive changes in mental health, which were initiated by Winston Churchill, pursued more by Enoch Powell, and kind of finalized by Margaret Thatcher, which was the movement of mental health services from these large asylums, some of them holding up to almost 5,000 patients, the average number being about 1,700, out into the community. A fantastic and sympathetic and compassionate achievement. Mental health also pioneered the use of multidisciplinary teams for the treatment of difficult and not so difficult conditions. It pioneered multi-professionalism in a way that the rest of the NHS was in a fairly medical model. And it demedicalized many conditions. And as we look now at how we address some of the financial and service design elements of the NHS, we look at mental health and we say, maybe that's the model that we should be adopting for the treatment of long-term conditions, other long-term conditions. But my question, perhaps, to this audience is, has mental health gone too far in some of these areas? And if it has, what can we learn? And then on the 60th anniversary of the NHS, Ara Darzi published his deliberations following a review of the National Health Service. And I think we learned three things from that. The first was we learned we needed to focus on quality. The second was we learned that we needed greater leadership, particularly clinical leadership in the NHS. And thirdly, we learned that we needed a greater focus on personalization. And by personalization, I mean a spectrum of things. So at one end, the kind of fluffy stuff where you offer patients exactly the same courtesies and manners that you would offer to somebody coming to your own home. You stand up, you shake their hands, you treat them with decency when they come into the clinic. And then at the other end, a far more hardcore form of personalization, which is probably best articulated in pharmacogenetics and focusing of treatments on the right patients. And just when we had got to that, there was a global financial crisis. So we had got to a position where we were focusing on quality. There had been, since 1948, constant growth in the amount of money that was available for the NHS, running at somewhere between 4 and 5% per year, but over the last decade, closer to 10% per year. And suddenly, the amount of money that was available for the NHS was going to be roughly the same for the foreseeable future. But demand would continue to increase. And that meant that unless we did something, there would be a massive shortfall in the amount of money available to treat our patients. And that shortfall was estimated at about £20 billion over 3 years. Now, we've tackled that, and we're on target, although I think we've picked the low-hanging fruit. We think that we can get 40% out of that by sweating the assets of the NHS, increasing productivity. 40% by reducing and coordinating back office costs, and about 20% by redesign of clinical services. And that's the area that I think that I want to focus on and that I hope you do too. Because what we do know is that generally speaking, in any healthcare system, most in the course of treating most conditions, better care costs less. So in my specialty, where a colleague and I I was kind of peripheral to it, but he looked at the cost of coronary artery bypass surgery in Virginia, where all heart units were better than the national average in terms of their outcomes measured by mortality. And the difference in cost between the very best units in Virginia and the just a good unit was 30%. So, in other words, one unit cost $30,000 per operation, the other one cost $20,000. It was the very best unit, was 30% cheaper. So through NICE, we started to look at whether that observation held true in a lot of other conditions, and it does. So NICE are publishing that as on their website, so that information is available. So just when we were starting to address the £20 billion shortfall. The new coalition government came in, and there were a series of reforms which have already been alluded to. But the principles that were underpinning Andrew Lansley's reforms were, in my view, threefold. The first was that he wanted to make clinical outcomes the currency of the National Health Service. It's of interest to patients, and it's of interest to clinicians, because everybody wants the patient to get better, not least of all the patient. The second thing was he wanted to give clinicians a greater say in the strategic direction setting of the NHS and wanted to couple that with more accountability. And thirdly, he wanted to give patients more say in their own treatment. And when I scratch the paint off that, I think what that really means is turning our NHS into a much more customer-based service, which focuses on the customer in the same way that other service industries do. Now, one of the things that that I was charged with was trying to put some flesh on the bones of the concept of focusing on outcome measures. And one of the benefits of working in the Department of Health is there's some really, really smart civil servants. And Andrew Lansley originally had about seven measures that he thought would provide high-level measures of how well the NHS was going, and five of those were just mortality measures. One was about patient experience, and one was about serious untoward incidents. We took the view that with so few measures, those would become de facto targets, and people would focus on that at the expense of other things. So we went off to think about it, and one of the civil servants came back with the idea. He said, look, he said, the NHS should do five things. Firstly, it should stop you dying from things that it can stop you dying from. In other words, when you've got a stroke or a heart attack, recognizing that the major determinants of early mortality lie outside the jurisdiction of the NHS in places like transport, education, and so on and so forth. The second thing it should do is it should look after you well if you have some kind of long-term condition, such as asthma, rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes. Thirdly, it should look after you well if you require a short episode of care, whether it be a single quick episode of depression, a broken leg, or a cataract operation. Fourthly, it should treat you with decency. And fifthly, it should treat you in a safe manner. And so those became known as the five domains of the NHS. And we originally had 50 measures in those domains, not 60. I think 60 is too many. Actually, we had 51, and then I had to choose which one to take out, and I chickened out. So we stayed with 51 for a while, but that's crept up to 60. Now, that outcomes framework is simply a high-level dashboard. It's simply a dashboard to give those interested in the NHS some idea as to whether or not the NHS is doing well or not, which direction are the needles pointing. It's relatively live, and it's imperfect. There are two types of measures in there. So for mortality, there are a bunch of technocratic measures, and for safety, there are a bunch of technocratic measures. In the other domains, which are long-term conditions, short episodes of care, and patient experience, there's a mixture of technocratic measures, which are clinically orientated, and patient measures, because I'm very keen that we introduce a level of customer satisfaction and focus into the way we measure the NHS. Now, there are several mental health measures in the outcomes framework. So in domain one, we have potential years of life lost from causes amenable to healthcare. Do you know what the third biggest cause of life years lost in this country is? It's suicide. So addressing that can have a major impact on that particular indicator. The second one is excess mortality in patients with serious mental illness. So we focus very specifically on that. In domain two, one of the measures is the employment rate for people with mental illness. In domain four, patient experience of community mental health services. In domain five, safety incidents involving death or harm, which is obviously an issue of particular interest in mental health institutions. And in domain three, there are some others which are fairly broad, such as unnecessary emergency admissions. Now, many of these have a significant mental health illness, and I will come down to the IAPS measures in a moment, Richard. So the new commissioning board will be doing several things. The first thing is it will directly commission services to the tune of about £20 billion a year. And those will be highly specialist services, such as heart surgery, forensic psychiatry, mental health services and secure units. It will also commission directly primary care, general practice services. But it will also support the expenditure of the remaining NHS budget by clinical commissioning groups, 212 of them. And GPs see a lot of people with mental health, mainly people who are miserable, people who can't work, people who have broken lives. And you've already heard that that affects an awful lot of people. But they're going to be seeing those people at the time that the NHS is in the grip of the triple pincer of escalating healthcare costs, increasing demand, and a stagnant economy. So they're going to be asking, where will the money come from? Richard's implied that it may be revenue neutral. They will have to make some difficult choices about how much money they invest or how many services they commission related to mental health, cancer, cardiac disease, or musculoskeletal disease. So many of those decisions are going to be made locally at a time that the NHS is, in the name of the white paper that was published, being liberated from central control. So the CCGs have got choices to make. Some of those choices, frankly, are not going to be easy. They're going to be influenced by both a combination of clinical and economic arguments. And I think one of the key arguments is going to be what the value proposition is for new types of treatment. And I think one of the things that Richard Layard has done has very eloquently produced the economic arguments, which I think are remarkably powerful. I see Sally Davis in the audience. Sally and I have to read a lot of different papers, but I have to say, compared with most of the stuff we read, I found that riveting reading, actually, because it was brief, concise, and just packed with some pretty hard and irrefutable facts, in my view. So the issue then is, how do we make this stuff happen? And I think it's down to clinical leadership. Previously, the NHS consisted of an NHS board that hung out in the Department of Health. There were 10 SHAs, each with its own independent chairman, chief executive, board of directors, non-executive directors, 151 PCTs, each with an individual chairman, each with non-executive directors, each with a chief executive and some executive directors. A whole bunch of heterogeneous, semi-autonomous, semi-competitive organizations. Those 161 organizations have now been replaced by one organization with one board, one chief executive, one medical director, and a series of clinical leaders. That's the NHS Commissioning Board. But the job of the NHS Commissioning Board is also to support and help the 212 CCGs. And of course, one of the problems that's been referred to is that physical illness is simply not that mental illness is simply not afforded the same status as physical illness, either by the public or by the NHS, and quite frankly, not by many, many, many of the clinicians practicing in the NHS. And yet you've heard some pretty compelling arguments tonight that it should be. And I think there are issues there, because we've seen that mental illness is associated with mortality, something which is in many ways more tangible and people understand. But dealing with mental health is something about putting systemic compassion back into our NHS. So most people who work in the NHS go in on a day-by-day basis with compassion in their hearts, trying to treat patients to the best of their ability. But our staff surveys show that most of them think they're doing that despite the way the NHS is run, not helped by it. And I think we have quite a lot of work to do with that, on that. Now, I hear that we need more money in mental health services. I hear we need more money in every service that the NHS offers. It seems to me that in the new world, money should follow a sound business proposition. And all business propositions, in my view, are predicated on a very clear purpose that is defined and narrated, a clear set of objectives, a measurable set of outcomes, a clear lines of accountability, and strong leadership. And therein is my challenge to mental health. I think the financial arguments are very strong, but for me, the issue is how do we mobilize mental health clinical leadership? Where is the locus? So if I want to engage in discussions on surgery or anesthesia or dermatology, I know where to go. I don't really know where to go for mental health. And in part, that's because of some of the territorial and silo issues in the way that mental health is delivered. So I find myself asking for your help on that. Not long ago, we had a meeting in another part of this building to try and focus on venous thromboembolism, a condition which kills preventably 25,000 people a year in our National Health Service. I knew about it as a medical student. I knew about it as an SHO. I knew about it as a registrar. I knew about it as a consultant. The most striking thing was that nobody in the meeting argued about the data. They simply argued about what to do. And the president of the Royal College of Surgeons said to me, why don't you mandate it? And then the president of the Royal College of Physicians said, why don't you mandate the appropriate treatments for preventing that? And I walked back to my office thinking, what kind of position have we got to where the leaders of the medical profession turn to me as a dark agent of government saying, you tell us to do what you know we need to do. And then I realized that wasn't really what they were asking. They were saying, make the system more responsive to what clinicians knew had to be done. So what we did, we got the presidents of all the colleges together, the SHA medical directors, and we said, let's find common cause. What can you bring to this as clinical leaders? And they could bring communication, they could bring tribal endeavor to make sure that their members were focused on tackling venous thromboembolism. What I could do is go back to the NHS Operations Board and put the appropriate financial measures in place. And within under 2 years, we went from less than 40% of patients in our National Health Service receiving the appropriate assessment and treatment when they came into hospital to well over 90%. And I think in just over 2 years, we've got ourselves probably into the best position in the world, probably one of the most dramatic changes that this NHS has seen. And it was done through clinical leadership coupled with a clear moral, social, and professional imperative with the appropriate underpinning science coupled to the appropriate financial levers. So I find myself asking if there's something we can learn from that which will help us ensure that CCGs and others move forward with the sorts of therapies that Richard's outlined. So I'd like to focus this debate not on the evidence, I think that's pretty crystal clear, but on how we can speed up the uptake of these treatments given the strong case in the face of a very, very different National Health Service. Thanks very much.